Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I must say it's an absolute pleasure to see so many people here to celebrate a medieval event. Could you turn to page 10 in your conference booklet? This is where all my teachers' handouts can be found. I've got the task of taking you back a few years to 1258 and to describe what were the causes of the revolution of 1258. Do you know, in the trade, you're always told, never perform with children. Here we are. I was going to say, never perform with children, animals, or slide projectors. And it's come true this very morning for me. More for me. As Henry III languished in captivity after the Battle of Lewes, I'm sure he had plenty of time on his hands to ponder on the events that had brought him down. Now, we'll never know what went on in Henry's mind, but no doubt if he were given to introspection, he would have thought back to the year 1258 when his troubles all began. On Tuesday, the 30th of April, he experienced the first blast of rebellion when a group of magnates stormed into his palace at Westminster, frightened the life out of him, and demanded the reform of the realm. From then on, things went quickly downhill for Henry. In just under 2 months' time, at the end of June, at the Great Parliament at Oxford, he was forced to agree to a new political order. A new council of 15 was elected, along with a justiciar, that is, the modern equivalent would be sort of a cross between a prime minister and a chief justice, a chancellor, new head of the civil service, and a treasurer. And these were to now rule in the king's name for at least 12 years and to bring about reform of the realm. In other words, a revolution had happened. Now, revolution is a bit of a misnomer for the Middle Ages, but revolution it arguably was, because no medieval king willingly gave up his power. Furthermore, the revolutionaries were committed to reform the realm of, and not only central government, but also local government, and in the interests of all sections of society. The provisions of Oxford became, and the provisions of Oxford, this is the new constitution under which all this reforming government would happen. This became something of an ideology in its own right. It's the ideology of limited, responsible, and reforming kingship. It was an ideology very hard to extinguish, although Henry recovered power between 1261 and 1263. Loyalty to the provisions kept the flame of opposition alive. And at the Battle of Lewes, it finally brought him down and into the clutches of Simon de Montfort. Now, there's more to the revolution of 1258 than at first meets the eye. It was hardly conformed to the medieval stereotype of a rebellion. I mean, the Battle of Lewes, a good old-fashioned punch-up, is much more medieval. 1258 is rather peaceful, or at least it seemed to be at the time, though some historians nowadays are arguing it could have gone other ways and civil war broken out. It was also very sophisticated with propaganda, which sometimes concealed its true purposes. And there was also something rather curious about its leadership. There's always something to be gained by looking at the leadership of a revolution. We'd expect revolution leadership in this period, of course, to come from the aristocracy. But the leadership for 1258 came from inside the court of Henry III as much as from outside. It's something of a simplification to say that 1258 was all about a clash between Henry III and the English baronage. Henry III was brought down as much, if not more so, by members of his own family. And why had 1258 been like this? What were the causes of the 1258 revolution? Now, many may think that in answer to this, we have to look no further than at the personality of Henry III himself. He was hardly an ideal stereotype medieval king. We know roughly what he looked like. He was about 5'6" tall, strongly built, but with one outstanding physical defect, he got a slightly drooping eyelid. Matthew Paris, monk of St. Albans, is the great narrative source for this period, and he was an unsparing critic of all Henry's weaknesses, particularly his drooping eyelid, which you might possibly see in this image here. But more seriously, Matthew knew Henry very well, and he gives us a very vivid insight into Henry III, the man. The private Henry III had one of the most attractive personalities of a medieval king. He could be charming, even funny. He had an exemplary home life. He was genuinely pious and charitable. He was generous, forgiving, and approachable. He could inspire loyalty. The public Henry III, on the other hand, had a great sense of the majesty of monarchy. He loved ceremonial and dressing up. He was always trying to outdo the King of France with the grandeur of his court. He was a great art collector and loved grand paintings. Perhaps one of my favourite is a grand picture that he had painted for the Great Hall of Dublin Castle, portraying the King and the Queen seated together with their baronage. Now, this was a piece of propaganda designed simply to impress the Irish, because unfortunately Henry himself never made it over in person to Ireland. Henry spent a lot of money on palaces. He was particularly interested in domestic comforts, nice lavatories. Unfortunately, not very much has survived of his palaces, including a wonderful palace that he had done in a little palace down in Dorset, in Gillingham, which he had decorated at great expense, but he only ever occupied it for a couple of days. We've got, of course, one or two things surviving from Henry. We've got Westminster Abbey, there's his tomb at Westminster, an image of the Abbey. I'm sorry, it's very bad here, but you all know what Westminster Abbey looked like. And you've got the Great Hall at Winchester Castle. More seriously, and we must go back now to not what Henry would want us to look at, but at defects in his personality. All the experts agree with Matthew Paris that Henry had certain severe flaws of personality. He could sometimes be naive. He could sometimes be weak-willed and easily impressed by forceful ministers and particularly smart-talking foreigners. Matthew Paris is always going on about how Henry filled his court with glamorous, smart-talking foreigners, beginning with Simon de Montfort in the 1230s. And above all, as David Carpenter has shown us so magnificently, Henry was no good at warfare. He was completely disinterested in warfare. The Battle of Lewes was not his first military disaster. In fact, he got loads to his name. I particularly am fond of the farcical campaign that Henry conducted in Poitou in 1242-43. This is the last attempt to recover English lands lost to the King of France, and it all culminated in the Battle of Tyrburg, where Henry characteristically led the English army into a trap. And he was only got out of this trap when his resourceful brother, Richard of Cornwall, made a deal with the French knights, because they were both crusaders, and they had a crusader's day's grace. Richard then went back to Henry, and he said to him quite simply, "Let's get out of here pretty bloody quick." And they did. And they sort of clapped their spurs to their horses, and they ran. And that, I think, is Henry III in a nutshell. Yet, there was nothing inevitable about 1258. By 1258, Henry was in the 42nd year of his long reign. His rule had not been without success, at least until the mid-1250s. Now, Henry succeeded in 1216 at the age of only 9, which meant that until 1234, there was a minority under great ministers, Hubert de Burgh, Peter de Roche, and William the Marshal starting off. Henry had been left a terrible legacy by his father, King John. John's tyranny had lost the Angevin dynasty control of Normandy, Anjou, and Poitou, conquered by the King of France. Now, on the conference booklet on page 11, if you turn to page 11, the maps there, you can see where some of these territories were. And King John had nearly lost the Angevins, England as well, because he'd sparked off the great Magna Carta rebellion and civil war when a third of England had just simply opted for loyalty to the French Prince Louis. Henry's reign had restored loyalty to his dynasty. Now, the work of the ministers of the minority, of course, do need to be given credit here, but so too does Henry's personal rule beginning in 1234. It brought internal peace, prosperity, and stability, achievements of which Henry was indeed proud. And indeed, during his troubles after 1258, not surprisingly, he repeatedly reminded his subjects of the peace and tranquility that they had enjoyed under his rule. In many ways, Henry had learnt from King John's mistakes. John's tyrannies had given the English a taste for liberties. So Henry deferred to Magna Carta. And there was also Parliament. The ministers of the minority had repeatedly deferred to Parliament and to general consent in order to legitimise their rule. But so too did Henry. We'll be hearing a lot about Parliament later on this morning from Dr. Maddicott, the great expert on this subject. But I want to say that Henry held Parliament every year, and sometimes in sessions 3 times a year. And his successes in this period, at least to the mid-1250s, were based on his cultivation of the great and good, of the greatest and richest subjects in his realm, the multimillionaires of his day, figures with annual incomes ranging between 300 and 3,000 pounds. I'm talking here about the great barons and the great earls and the great bishops, people who owned castles and retinues of knights. These were the people who really mattered. Lesser barons and knights, in contrast, although they were very rich people, had incomes much less, ranging from, say, about £100 to perhaps as little as £20 per annum. Now, for the magnates, Henry's rule was mild, and he was very careful not to push political society too far. He was very approachable, as I say. He was very forgiving of baronial debts. Like King John, he didn't tour the realm all the time in suspicious searches of his enemies. He lived for large swathes of the time in his palace at Westminster. And the great and good were readily attracted to Henry's court. It was full of entertainment, very glittering. He's helped here by his wife, Queen Eleanor. Unfortunately, this is the only image we have of Queen Eleanor, which is actually a very grand lady, very intelligent and very resourceful. And although she was a foreigner, Eleanor came from Provence, she was very careful, as Margaret Howell, I think, has shown, to cultivate both Englishmen and foreigners in her patronage. And this was a time also when the English aristocracy was in any case, being in a process of being remodeled. Exactly during this period, there were a series of chance deaths and minorities amongst the great English earls, in fact, affecting over half of them, which left lots of gaps to fill, wardships and minorities. And during this period, Henry began to collect English earldoms for his family. His brother, Richard of Cornwall, was Earl of Cornwall. His eldest son, Edward, Earl of Chester. Leicester, went to Simon de Montfort, who was now Henry III's half-brother. We must never, and we must never forget this, that Simon was Henry's brother-in-law. And he also collected earldoms for his foreign relations. Although they were never officially created English earls, there was the earldom of Richmond for the Queen's uncle, Peter of Savoy, and there he is portrayed outside his London residence, which is now the Savoy Hotel, and Richmond Castle in Yorkshire. That's one of two castles he held. Pevensey was the other one. And also an earldom of Pembroke for Henry's half-brother, Poitevin, William de Valence. There he is in his tomb at Westminster Abbey, and Goodrich Castle in Herefordshire, one of three castles he held. The others were Pembroke and Hertford Castle. And Henry also even collected bishoprics, powerful bishoprics for his family in this period. The Archbishopric of Canterbury for Peter of Savoy's brother Boniface, Winchester for William de Valence's brother Aymer, who's here. There he is in his tomb at Winchester Cathedral. He's sometimes known as Bishop-elect of Winchester because for the first 10 years of his career, in fact, just before he died, he was unconsecrated as Bishop of Winchester. And in addition to all this, as if to reinforce all this policy, Henry married a series of his foreign kinswomen to the great and good in English society, a series of marriages between all these ladies and at least five English earls and four of the richest barons took place. And you can find out more about this in my extremely illegible family trees in the conference booklet on page 14. And I assure you they're all there, and particularly like to draw your attention on just the top line of the Lusignans to marriage between William de Valence's sister Alice and Louis's own John de Warenne, which took place in 1247. They only had a very short marriage, and unfortunately there's a bit of a mistake on my handout here. They actually did have three children. It's a very happy marriage, even though it was very short-lived. John de Warenne never married again. Now, we can see the advantages of this in new relation between Henry and the great and good early on in the famous crisis spanning November 1244 and February 1245. After this monumental defeat that Henry had had in Poitou, he returned home in England in disgrace. And indeed, some people in Parliament even drew up a paper constitution threatening to put all the institutions of central government under parliamentary control. But nothing happened. Why? Well, because the great and good had supported Henry. One could hardly think of any greater contrast with King John. Just after his defeat at the Battle of Bouvines, King John was set immediately on course for Magna Carta. Even as late as 1255, Matthew Paris could despair of opposition making any headway, for Henry, as he put it, had successfully enticed into a league with him many, in fact, all of the nobles of England.